Welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell. A new Australian-specific position statement for the hormonal management of adult, transgender and gender-diverse individuals has been published in the journal. And I'm lucky enough today to have the lead author as my special guest. Dr. Ada Chung is an NHMRC research fellow at the University of Melbourne, and she's also an endocrinologist at Austin Health. Do we know how many Australians are transgender or gender-diverse?
We have no good way of knowing precisely because there is no capturing of gender identity in the census. That is going to change with the next census. Once we have more visibility, then we can get a better understanding about health needs. But from overseas research, it's very difficult to get a population studies because there's a whole lot of stigma about identifying and coming out.
Yes.
But people estimate that somewhere between 0.1% of the population, up to 2-3% even of young people identify as gender variant. My best guess would be approximately 0.5%. Which equates to about 150,000 Australians.
Is that number growing in the sense that not that there are more and more people who are transgender or gender diverse, but that more people are happy to identify that way?
Yes. I think in the last 10 years, particularly since Caitlyn Jenner's come out and there's been more visibility of trans people in the public eye, people are seeing that, there are other people like me and people can come out and come out successfully and transitioning is an option. And so we've seen a tenfold rise in people coming to our clinics in Victoria over 5 years, and similar rises are being seen worldwide. And I think it's not because of more people are trans or gender diverse. It's that people are feeling more comfortable to seek help and come out.
Is part of that the medical care for TGD people is becoming more understanding and appropriate and safe?
Yes, we're learning more and more as time goes on. There's very little research to guide clinical care, and research is most certainly in its infancy. And we extrapolate a lot from how we treat other cisgender people with low hormones, how we treat menopause or premature menopause, or how we treat hypogonadism in cisgender males. And it's the same principles. So the medicine itself, the hormonal treatment, is the same. As we use the same doses, the same drugs as we would to treat low sex hormone levels in other conditions. But the research specifically in the trans and gender diverse population is lacking. But that's changing slowly. Research takes time, and we're learning new things all the time. We're learning things from, big cohorts that have undergone treatment in Europe and in the States, and trying to get an understanding about what the long-term health effects are and what the risks are and how we can best to minimise them.
Why was there a need for an Australian-specific position statement or guidelines?
That's a really good question. First of all, it started off with the community, patients. And they were coming to us saying that, every doctor I treat does a different thing, if they can find a doctor to treat them. But the biggest issue was that they couldn't find doctors willing to treat them. And so we did a survey of about nearly 1,000 trans Australian adults. And we asked them, what was their biggest health issue? And where would they direct government funding if they could choose one priority? And I thought it was going to be, more gender clinics or hormone therapy or mental health support. But the biggest thing that the community wanted was better training for doctors in trans health.
Wow.
And that came as a real surprise to me. And then we also surveyed doctors and we asked them what their experience was with treating trans people. And it wasn't that they didn't want to treat trans people. It was that they didn't know.
Yes.
And 96% of them had never been taught about trans health in medical school. And the large majority lacked confidence. And overwhelmingly, more than 95% supported development of an Australian guideline.
Yes.
And when we asked the community, they also supported an Australian guideline. And clinicians. So we went to ANZPAS at the time, Australian New Zealand Professional Association for Transgender Health, and we did a survey of people experiencing trans health, and they also supported development of a local guideline. because the treatments that we have in Australia that are available are different to that in the state or overseas. So there has been US-based guideline published a few years ago, and also the World Professional Association has standards of care, which was published several years ago, which are a little bit out of date. They're very much based on mental health assessment type of approach, whereas we were really, the community were calling for more of an informed consent process where the trans individual decides for themselves in consultation with their treating doctor the pros and cons about whether to have hormone therapy, and the treating doctor would do an assessment of their mental health and ensure appropriate mental health support without necessarily formally going through a psychiatrist or psychologist assessment. So we're moving a little bit more away from that, and we have specific restrictions in testosterone treatment in Australia on the PBS. And so there were certain things that, well, I was getting asked the same questions from doctors, how do I prescribe testosterone? And so we needed a local guideline about how to access medications in Australia.
Is testosterone not a PBS-approved indication?
It is PBS-approved, okay. But it's approved for specific indications.
And transgender, gender-diverse treatment, hormonal treatment is not one of those?
I've had many discussions with PBS regarding this, and it's not specifically listed because the drug companies haven't done studies specifically in trans people and haven't specifically applied to the PBAC to get transgender listed. Yeah. However, transgender men are males and they have low testosterone levels, so they have androgen deficiency.
Yes.
And they don't have testicles, so we've been able to use the indication androgen deficiency due to an established testicular disorder. And when I've checked this with the PBS, they have said that for specific patients, they have said that this is okay, but an individual clinician needs to make that assessment. These restrictions that were placed upon testosterone in about 2015 were not designed to limit treatment for trans people. They were designed to limit the overuse of testosterone prescribing in aging males without clear indications. And so there was several restrictions that, you know, for PBS testosterone, it needed to be in consultation with an endocrinologist or a sexual health physician or a urologist or a pediatric endocrinologist. Mm-hmm. And so for prescribing for trans males, it's not a simple thing of just getting a testosterone script. There are a few loops and hurdles that we have to jump over because of these PBS restrictions, and that were relevant only to Australia.
Is there a movement afoot to get those PBS restrictions lifted?
The only way that it would be possible would be if a drug company, which I don't have any control over, did a study in transgender people and the pharmaceutical companies applied to the PBAC to get the listing.
Are there similar hurdles for feminising hormone therapy?
No. Anybody with a prescriber number can prescribe estradiol therapy, and it's much easier.
Your position statement go through recommendations for the various stages of taking a trans person through this process. The first thing you mentioned is a mental health review. How important is that?
Being trans or gender diverse isn't a mental health condition, but being trans is associated with often other mental health conditions due to various contributing factors such as depression and anxiety, and sometimes even neurodevelopmental conditions like autism spectrum or ADHD, which may require more specialised support, specialised treatment. And so mental health support is really individualised depending on the individual patient. And many trans and gender diverse people have no mental health conditions and may not necessarily need specific mental health support or treatment if they have a good clinician, good GP. GPs manage mental health all the time.
They
and,
certainly do.
They have a good GP who is willing to support them through the challenges of transition because, you know, if someone starts hormone therapy, that can certainly cause mental health stressors. Then the individual may not need a mental health professional. However, mental health professionals can play an important role. If depression or anxiety is a problem, or if there's any concern about other conditions that might be at play, any sort of mental health condition, be it identity disorder or any sort of psychosis, then certainly I would involve a mental health professional. And I often do. For many people, having mental health support can only be a good thing from my perspective. The more support, the better.
Is it as simple as getting the pronouns right, getting the name right? Is it that easy to start with?
No, there's much more than that. That's an excellent first step, though. Feeling affirmed and feeling respected is really important for everybody. And using the name that the person uses and the pronoun that they use goes a long way towards developing rapport and helping a person understand that this clinician understands them. And misgendering or not using the pronoun can cause a lot of distress and cause a lot of mental health distress. So it's really important. It's like a core identity being addressed by the name that you use. But there's many other factors that influence someone's mental health. There's stigma, there's discrimination, there's difficulty getting employment, there's worry about family acceptance, there's worry about abuse walking down the street. There's worries about distress towards your own body, body dysphoria without anyone else, internal distress. And there's life. So there's depression and anxiety from other life events and and factors as well. So it's not just pronouns. Getting someone's name and pronoun right goes a long way, but that's not the only thing that people need. Everybody's complex and individual, so it just depends.
I'm chatting today with Ada Chung, an endocrinologist with Austin Health and the University of Melbourne. You can find her co-authored position statement at mja.com.au, where it is open access. If you're enjoying this pod, you can also subscribe to our feed on iTunes for free. Bonus. Back to our chat. Are TGD people good at going to the doctor? Is it something they do easily?
I see a lot of patients who have feared going to a doctor, and often when I see people for the first time, they're very anxious because they're not sure of the way that I will respond or I will react, and they fear discrimination. And that's a completely understandable fear, because when we look at the data, 28% of people have received discrimination in the healthcare setting. You know, we've had patients being abused in the waiting room and told to get out of the waiting room because people don't treat, you know, the doctor doesn't treat people like you. So this fear is real and valid. And I think clinicians need to understand that. And if a patient is feeling anxious and uptight, it may be why. And the patient may not have been to see a doctor for a long time, or they may have had medical issues and avoided going to the doctor because of the fear of how this doctor will respond to them. Or maybe they have a medical issue completely unrelated to being trans. And sometimes people have had experiences where a clinician will only focus on the trans status. They come in for a sore knee, completely unrelated, but they get asked invasive questions about their gender or their sexual health, which is not relevant to their presenting problem. And so there's often fear, and I think putting someone at ease, and the medical assessment itself is actually fairly straightforward, and and clinicians and GPs and endocrinologists are certainly, sexual health physicians are more than capable of performing a medical assessment. But it's, I think, taking the opportunity when someone does come for a medical assessment to assess, you know, preventative health care.
So it's an opportunity to...
Opportunity to address health and well-being and preventative care.
Are there any conditions that preclude someone from getting hormone therapy?
There are a few. So it's an individual assessment, and for example, someone who has an estrogen-dependent malignancy like breast cancer, it would not be advisable to take estrogen. And it's a balance about risks and benefits, and that's an individualised discussion. Like if someone said to me, look, you know, I don't care about the risk of breast cancer, I'm going to commit suicide if I don't get this treatment. You know, it's a balance about the risks of that individual's mental health and their and the harm that I'm causing by preventing them from accessing hormone therapy compared to the risk of the hormone treatment. It depends on the individual. But if someone had severe liver disease, liver failure, or a hormone-dependent malignancy, or unstable mental health that was unrelated, you know, severe psychosis, then I'd be wary about giving hormone treatment.
Let's talk about the specific therapy. Masculinizing hormone therapy is about testosterone.
That's right.
What are the dose recommendations? What are the recommendations for follow up and monitoring?
We use standard doses of testosterone that we use for hypogonadal cisgender men, and so the two common options in Australia are on the PBS, long acting intramuscular testosterone undecanoate, which is Reandron, which is given as an injection every 12 weeks, typically, with the first two doses being 6 weeks apart, because we give a loading dose at 6 weeks, and then it's 12 weekly, typically. And with Riandron or testosterone undecan 08, we adjust the frequency, although it's typically 12 weekly, you know, after 3 or 4 doses achieve steady state, and we adjust the dosing frequency based on the trough total testosterone level. So we know that after an injection, the levels will go up. So we aim for the level just before a dose of the lower end of the male reference range, approximately 10 to 15 nanomoles per litre, because we know that after the injection, it will go up after that. And we want to monitor for things like polycythemia, which is probably the most common side effect of excessively high testosterone levels. So hemoglobin and hematocrit, acne, oily skin, which is worse when testosterone levels are too high. And they would be the main things. There's also transdermal testosterone given as a gel or a cream. And I'd use standard daily doses. And in those, you know, with the gel, we don't aim for, or transdermal doses, we don't aim for a trough level, but just a level somewhere in the male reference range, typically between 10 to 30 nanomoles per litre. And these doses will achieve masculinization and typically cause menstrual suppression and lowering of the voice and change in the body shape. And so in addition to monitoring for polycythemia, there's a bit of uncertainty about the long-term effects on cardiovascular health with testosterone treatment. So I think it's probably a good thing for anybody to assess cardiovascular risk factors like stopping smoking and checking a lipid profile and glucose to ensure that cardiovascular risk factors are mitigated as best as possible. Masculinizing hormone therapy works really well to masculinize a person's physical characteristics.
Are there any downsides apart from possible cardiovascular downsides?
There has been a fear that giving testosterone may cause unstable mood, but the research doesn't support that. You know, there is a change in cognition, and there hasn't been research to describe exactly what those changes are, because testosterone does things to the brain. I don't think there's anything to suggest that it causes anything severe, doesn't cause mental health conditions, but there's always a risk that mood may change, often for the better.
Let's have a chat about feminizing hormone therapy. What are the options, and what's the course of treatment?
So we're quite limited in Australia with the options of feminising hormone treatment on the PBS and TGA approved. We only have oral estrogen, such as estradiol valerate or transdermal estradiol, which come in patches or a gel that are applied. And they're typically, the oral tablets are given daily and the transdermal patches are given twice weekly or weekly and the gels are given daily. And so that's quite effective at increasing estrogen levels and allowing feminization. But it doesn't, once someone has been through a male puberty in the past, we can't reverse those features. So things like a lowered voice, we can't reverse that with estrogen therapy. We can't reverse bony structure of the face or of the shoulders. Can't reverse the Adam's apple, and often we can't reverse hair growth completely. And so in addition to estrogen, we will often, some people will also need medications to block testosterone, antiandrogens, colloquially testosterone blockers. The most common formulations would be oral soprodrolone acetate or oral spironolactone, which are often used to treat hirsutism in cisgender women. So they will lower their testosterone levels to typically a female range, although not always with spironolactone, because of the spironolactone blocks the effect of testosterone but doesn't block the production, whereas soprodrolone will block the effect of testosterone and block the production of testosterone.
Sounds like there's the prospect of a lot of future research on this side of the...
There certainly is.
Yeah.
And we're trying to do that. So we find testosterone will masculinize very effectively. Estrogens work, but they are slower and they take time. And women often need other things to assist feminization. So, for example, like permanent hair removal with laser or electrolysis is often needed. So we just did a study and we found that 18% of trans women had some sort of gender-affirming surgical procedure, but 64% of them desired surgery in the future. So more people desire it than have had it, and I think that's because of cost and lack of availability. But certainly many trans women want gender-affirming surgery. Not all, but many do.
Ada, if you could wave a magic wand, what would be one of the first things you'd do in terms of making transition easier or more effective or cheaper or more accessible? What would you pick as your first choice if you could do anything?
If I could wave a magic wand, I'd actually wave the magic wand at society rather than trans people, because I think if the general Australian community understood that being trans is not a choice and there is a biological, whilst there are many factors, mm-hmm. there is a strong evidence to support a biological basis. Certainly, no one chooses to be trans, and even if they did, what's the problem with that? So I think waving the wand at a society that understands gender diversity and respects diversity and individuality and individual expression would go a long way to improving the mental health of many people, including the trans community, because that is the biggest thing. I think everybody in society wants to live a life where they can go about being themselves without fear, safely, without discrimination, yeah. without abuse, and being able to access the healthcare that they need safely in the way that is necessary for them to live a life freely and actively participate in society. That's what's needed. But if we can't get there, the next step would be to have a multidisciplinary gender service accessible for all Australians, and yeah. to start with at least in every major city where it's multidisciplinary so people have access, and also to have trans health more widely accepted in primary care and mm-hmm. to mainstream hormone therapy and trans health care, primary care, with the support of, you know, specialised services, because we're not going to be able to mainstream, for example, gender-affirming surgery. Things like being able to go to a doctor without any doctor, without fear of discrimination, to access mm-hmm. any sort of health care, I think is a basic need that everybody in the community wants.
Do you think it's a generational thing? Will it get better as time goes on, in other words?
I'm certainly hoping so. And I think it's going to change as we get trans health incorporated into health professional curriculum.
Well, that was my next question. What would you do about medical education?
So, for example, with the data that I talked about where the community saw training for doctors as the biggest health issue, we showed that data to the Victorian government, and they have responded by investing in a statewide training program for health yeah. professionals across Victoria, which yeah. is about to launch later this year. So initiatives like this is going to change things. But that's just Victoria. We want this sort of happening all over Australia. Yeah. So that, you know, some attempt to increase visibility and increase understanding of trans people and trans health, but also getting it seen in the curriculum, and we're working on that. If people hear about it, they don't need to know the ins and outs of, you know, specific treatments. They just need to know that trans people are just ordinary people who have a name and identify a certain way, and that should be respected. The main takeaway is that the medical aspects of treating trans people are mm-hmm. fairly straightforward, and I'm hoping that this position statement will give doctors a guide. So GPs who happen to have never seen a trans patient and they have a trans patient coming to them for the first time, that they can pick this up, go, oh, yeah, okay. I know what to do. Yeah. I can treat you. I don't have to send you somewhere. I don't have to say I don't know what to do.
GPs actually can get this done without specialist help. If
and that's
they
do. The way... They do. I have lots of GPs, like patients who come, who have excellent treatment in primary care, and they don't need to see an endocrinologist necessarily. As an endocrinologist, I should be there for support if anyone needs it. So if mm-hmm. anyone's not comfortable treating them, I'm going to be there. But if they are comfortable, go for it. Nice. And I'm hoping that this document will help make people comfortable.
Ada, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.